Amen. Second reading today comes from the book of Job. I'm going to be jumping around a little bit. You can follow along in the Pew Bible around pages 486-ish. I'm going to be in and around chapters 40 and 42. Look at Behemoth, which I made just as I made you. It eats grass like an ox. Its strength is in its loins, and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are knit together. Its bones are tubes of bronze, its limbs like bars of iron. It is the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with the sword. Even if the river is turbulent, it is not frightened. It is confident, though Jordan rushes against its mouth. Can one take it with hooks or pierce its nose with a snare? And now concerning Leviathan, this is Job 41. Its back is made of shields in rows, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. Its sneezes flash forth light, and its eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. On earth it has no equal, a creature without fear. It surveys everything that is lofty. It is king over all that are proud. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So what is this world in which we live? I like to start off with easy questions. But we've all been around for at least long enough, some more than others, some less, to have some idea of its turnings. Not that we have understanding of it, but at least sort of comfortable in the familiar things that we know, its predictabilities. Well, Job thought he knew the world he lived in too. Now, we talked a lot about Job in the last few months. Lou did a long series on it, so I don't want to go into too much detail about the backstory, but just let's just remember that Job is, when we first meet Job, he's described as one who fears God. He's a man who's righteous before God, and he won't curse God. He's wealthy, he has a large family, and he has friends, he's known in the community. These are things that he knows, he's come to rely on, these predictabilities, his family, his welfare, his friends, and that if he's good, God will bless him. These are the things that have come to define his worldview. But then, of course, it's all taken away. Now, the majority of the book of Job is spent with these arguments with his friends, but we're going to skip over that. It seems to me that Job really boils down to just a few things. Everything that Job thought he knew deserted him. His friends left him, thought he must have done something wrong against God. And then, of course, for to have all these things taken away and not having done anything wrong turned this other worldview upside down, that if you do good, God will bless you. We think we may know creation, but creation does not conform to our lives. And when we see God speaking, so Job, what I read, this was God speaking out of the whirlwind. Job demands an answer, and God finally comes and says, "All right, Job, here I am. Here's my voice. Listen to what I tell you." So God speaks about creation at length, out of creation, out of this whirlwind. We expect this world, we expect it to have order, beauty, logic. And it does, for sure, but not necessarily in the ways that we are used to, or the ways that we would sometimes imagine. We style ourselves as the world's creators, so often projecting our own conceptions of what the world should be over and against God's unique and sometimes incomprehensible creation. We're so accustomed to thinking of God in sober terms. We're comfortable talking about God's sound moral character. Exodus 34, he's merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. The idea that God might have aesthetic preferences is strange and seems a little frivolous as well. Let's take a moment and just experience these passages. They are so detailed about every little speck about Leviathan and all these scales and how closely they fit together and Behemoth, the sinews of its muscles. This is not really my first reaction to hearing about these two creatures. Commonly modernized as a Behemoth is a hippopotamus and Leviathan as some kind of crocodile. Of course, now these are epic proportions, not a hippopotamus we'd see in the zoo, but the first great act of God. You know, we understand them as dangerous and certainly mysterious. We see them and are like, wow, that's an amazing creature, but what is it? But God revels in every aspect of their creation. Behemoth is the first great act of God, we're told. Leviathan, each scale so intricately placed into one another. These are masterpieces of God's genius. And an example of how we cannot understand the fullness of God's creation. When God confronts Job with the reality of creation, he is in effect asking Job if he can love what he cannot control. He says, I'm paraphrasing here, look away from yourself, Job. Look around you. For a moment, see the world with my eyes in all its intricacy and wild beauty. The beauty is in the wildness, Job. You cannot tame all that frightens you without losing that beauty. God calls this man of integrity, this man who's righteous before God, who fears God, Job, he calls him to take his place in this creation, this ravishing but dangerous world, where only those who relinquish their personal expectations can live in peace. So once again, this question that God poses, can you love what you cannot control? The shocking truth about creation and God's agency in it is that God gets a kick out of doing things for reasons we don't really understand. Making it rain on the desert, for instance, with no one there, seems quite pointless. Can you love what you cannot control? I want us to keep this question in mind, but I really want to move forward to Matthew, where Elise read for us. I'm not finished with Job. We'll get back to him. But this question, can you love what you cannot control? I want us to keep this in mind as we really dig into Matthew. Now, I must say, those who are in my class this morning will get a little of a double dose, but not too much. It's nice when research you're doing tends to help out multiple avenues. But tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, and I think we're all aware of that. And tonight there's another service, which will be fantastic, I'm sure. But I've been thinking about the idea of preaching Martin Luther King Sunday, and I've never really preached on a holiday-related Sunday before. So I was thinking about what I was going to do, and I was remembering a conversation I had with a friend of mine. We were getting coffee, and he's not a Christian. Well, I don't want to go into it. He reads the Bible a lot, but he says he's spiritual but not religious, you know, one of those kind of things. But we were having this conversation about, you know, this, that, and the other, and he started talking about the Bible, and he's like, yeah, you know, the Bible's great, you know, it's really nice, what a nice book. It's got a lot of great sayings, and, you know, of course, now I'm just waiting for, you know, for the kicker to come in, and he goes, but, you know, and of course, he obliges, he goes, all these things, they're all just pithy and, you know, kind of absurd, you know, Jesus is all smart, but he's very naive. He says, a lot of what he says, I just can't take seriously. He goes on to mention this specific passage from Matthew, he said, like, take for what he says, turn the other cheek. He said, that's ridiculous. And we talked about it for a while, but I hadn't really thought about it all that much. I wasn't really prepared for his arguments. And but it stayed with me. I was like, wow, you know, I disagree with him a lot, my friend, but I wasn't really sure what exactly Jesus was saying here. I think it's one of the this Matthew 38-42 is one of the harder teachings of Jesus, to do these things. Turn the other cheek, give up your cloak, go the extra mile. And they're so often turned into these quick, short, pithy sayings that it's not hard to understand why people think that Jesus' teachings might be outdated or idealistic. But given that tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, I really want to talk about this passage because it's this very passage that is the inspiration for Dr. King's amazing philosophy of nonviolent action. And I think it all really stems from the history of interpretation around this passage. And the common, the modern way of just taking little bits of it out of context. The phrase in verse 38, "Do not resist an evildoer," is traditionally thought of as being equivalent to non-resistance to evil. And this seems to me a very odd conclusion, especially when you consider Jesus' life. And every occasion, Jesus himself resisted evil with every fiber of his being. The 5th century theologian Augustine, he agreed with the gospel in a very basic sense with this idea of non-resistance. And he therefore declared that a Christian must not attempt self-defense. However, he creates a loophole here. He says, if someone is attacking my neighbor, then the love commandment of Jesus requires me to defend my neighbor by force of arms if necessary. Lo and behold, Augustine has created the just war tradition for us. This military conception that is used to justify, in Augustine's case, the defense of the Roman Empire, torture, capital punishment. And following his lead for centuries, Christians have ever since been justifying similar wars fought for sometimes something as little as just national interest. Now, Augustine teaches non-resistance, but he finds a loophole for violence. The gospel, on the other hand, does not teach non-resistance to evil, nor does it teach violence. There are no loopholes in Jesus' teaching. The word used here in verse 39, "Do not resist an evildoer," the word used in the Greek, it's antistenai, which literally means to stand against. Now, what a lot of translators overlook is that in the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, this word antistenai is the technical term for warfare. It describes the way that two armies would march towards each other, and then when their ranks meet, they would literally stand against each other, and then they would fight. So this is the language here. And it's the same language we find in Ephesians, in Paul's letter in chapter 6. "Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, so that you may be able to withstand," antistenai, "on that evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm." Now here, Jesus is not telling us to submit to evil, but he's also not telling us to make war against it. He is decidedly telling us to oppose it, and this is the key, to oppose it on different terms, to refuse to oppose evil on evil's terms. We are not to let the opponent dictate the methods of our opposition. Jesus is urging us to transcend passivity and to transcend violence. He wants us to find a third way, one that is at once assertive and yet nonviolent. Excuse me. Maybe a better translation of this passage, of this verse, would be, "Don't react violently against one who is evil." Or some of the early epistles, like Romans and 1 Thessalonians, say, "Do not repay evil for evil." This would be a much better interpretation or translation of this verse. And this is Dr. King's impetus for reaction to oppression. A response, not an equal response of violence, but what he refers to as nonviolent direct action. I love this term. It includes all of the key elements of Jesus' third way. In his famous letter from Birmingham Jail, which I encourage all of you to read, it's quite impressive, Dr. King is responding to religious leaders in the area. They're white, and they published this statement of concern and caution in regards to Martin Luther King and his followers' protests. This is shortly following a controversial election of Bull Connor, who's He's the commissioner of public safety, so he's the head of the police department and the fire department, and an outspoken agent of segregation. Now, these religious leaders, they called these present activities of the demonstrators, they called them unwise, untimely, and they deplored them as exciting violence. And they therefore labeled the demonstrations themselves as violent. Dr. King responds saying, "We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." He defends his protests and highlights a very important aspect of them. He says that nonviolent direct action is a definite response, but it seeks to create such a crisis and establish such creative tension that a community that has consistently refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. The purpose of direct action is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. That's one of the main arguments that these religious leaders who wrote this article were saying, why don't you try to negotiate? And Dr. King is saying, we must have nonviolent direct action to be able to seek negotiation. And it's this idea, creative tension. This is such a great image. It invites a person to observe something in a new way by highlighting its strangeness, its uniqueness, sometimes its problems. And I think tension, it's a perfect word here. It's a very powerful force, tension. And however small it begins, by definition, it is that which builds. What at first we are invited to see, later as the tension builds more and more and more, we are forced to see. This is the same principle that Jesus employs in his parables, his sermons, sayings, and actions. We did a long series on parables this summer, and this is the way Jesus acts. He presents the status quo as it is, and then he turns it on his head. He redefines it, usually in a radical way, and usually a controversial way, surprising us with this tension, forcing us to think about it more, to recognize it and to confront it as fallacy, or at the very least, as something that must be reexamined. So what does it mean to turn the other cheek? Despite a new way to understand resistance, Jesus' example still sounds very passive. Be a rug, let them walk over you, just let them hit you again. But there's an important cultural context at work here. King's notion of creative tension requires an action to highlight a problem, whether it be a march or a sit-in. Now, turning the other cheek doesn't seem like enough of an action. But when we understand the stigma, the cultural stigma that Jesus is speaking to, it's actually a very powerful way to defy one who's oppressing you. When Jesus says, "But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also," usually, I mean, I would imagine a blow with a fist. This seems to be the common aggressing act. Lou, I could use the demonstration. I'm just kidding. If you think about it, this is impossible. I can't really understand a way you could strike the right cheek with the right fist. And it's important to know that the blow must be stricken with the right hand. The left hand is reserved for unclean acts only. If you use it simply to gesture, and when you're in this context, it means exclusion, it means penance, it means purifying yourself. So the left hand you can't use to touch other people, whether they might be unclean. So you can't hit with the fist, because that would be the left cheek. So if you think about it, it must be the back of the hand. If it must be the right hand, it must be the back of the hand. Now, the back of the hand is reserved for one purpose. It's not a blow to injure. It's a blow designed to insult or humiliate or degrade, put someone in their place. It was never administered to an equal. It was only administered to an inferior. Masters backhanded their slaves, husbands their wives, parents their children, Romans Jews. The whole point of the blow is to force someone who is out of line back into place. And if you notice Jesus' audience, he's speaking to these who are marginalized. And he's telling these people, if anyone strikes you, now these are people who are used to this treatment. They're used to being degraded. He's saying to them, refuse to accept this kind of treatment anymore. If they backhand you, turn the other cheek. Literally, turn the other cheek. Now, if you get struck on the right cheek with the backhand and then you turn your cheek to present the other one, they can no longer backhand you and they'll hit you in the face. The only other way to hit for them to strike you is with a fist to the left cheek. Now, if they decide to make this choice and to hit your left cheek with their fist, yes, you get hit, but what you're doing is you're making them treat you as an equal. The only way you would strike somebody with a fist is if you were fighting somebody on your own level. Two soldiers would fight each other with fists. Two slaves would fight each other with fists. Two masters would do the same. You're raising the other person to your level. And now this, they didn't want to do this. It'd be giving them this extra power that they've been denying them for so long. By turning the cheek, the inferior person is saying, I'm a human being. I refuse to be humiliated any longer. I am your equal. If you're going to hit me again, you know that I am your equal. Now, obviously, such defiance is not a good way to avoid trouble. Meek acquiescence is what the master is expecting and what they want. And if you deny them this, they are probably going to act out again. Maybe you'll be whipped or not fed or something. But the point has been made. The powers that be have lost their power to make others submit. And when large numbers begin behaving like this, you begin to have a social revolution. Gandhi is famous for saying, the first principle of nonviolent action is that of non-cooperation with everything humiliating. This is quite different from the usual view of turning the other cheek so our batterer can simply clobber us again. Jesus is saying, stand up, defy your masters, assert your humanity. But do not answer the oppressor in kind. Find that third way that is neither cowardly submission nor violent reprisal. Regardless of how we turn the other cheek, or how we treat those in power, we cannot control those who have power over us. Those who desire power and desire to lord it over you, we cannot control how they understand the world and how their perverted perception of their place in it gives them a further perverted entitlement to treat you a certain way. We cannot control that. But we can control how we react to them. The white religious leaders to whom Martin Luther King was responding further accuse him of being an extremist. His nonviolent protests they labeled them as extreme. And this is how Dr. King responds. He says, I must admit that I was initially disappointed in being so categorized. But as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a bit of satisfaction from being considered an extremist. Was not Jesus an extremist in love? Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you. The question is not whether we will be extremists, says Dr. King, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate, or will we be extremists for love? In his letter from Birmingham jail, Some of Dr. King's more prophetic words really struck me while thinking about my friend and the conversation we had and the disagreements we had. One of Dr. King's biggest disappointments amidst all the oppression and the violence is the church. The church's response in all of this. He talks about how the church was once a powerful institution. we look, I mean, we can see it in Acts. Wherever the early Christians entered a town, the power structure got disturbed. Immediately, the early Christians were convicted of being disturbers of the peace. But they continued on, whether they were cast in jail, stoned, exiled. They were small in number, but they brought an end to so many injustices, infanticide, gladiatorial contests, slavery, many other things. King speaks at length about the way the church is now. He says, things are different now. The contemporary church is so often a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. It is so often the arch supporter of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's often vocal sanctions of things as they are. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If the church of today does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authentic ring, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. I meet young people every day whose disappointment with the church has risen to outright disgust. So much for this warning. 40-some years ago, it's easy if you just substitute 20th century, if you substitute 21st century, we have just about the same problem here. We wonder where all the young people have gone. That's sort of the buzz question in the church these days. You know, and if we find them, we'll be set. But it's obvious, they've gone to places where their voices can be heard, where their discontent at injustice isn't silenced and offered up to the operant power structure as an empty sacrifice. The church today that Martin Luther King was speaking about has become the church now. I want to sit down again with my friend and bring up this passage again and ask him, why does he think Jesus is naive? Is it because of the things Jesus did, or is it because of the things the church does today? I want to lift up Dr. King's example. Jesus taught us how to love, how to be extremists. Martin Luther King demonstrated Jesus' love and extremism in powerful ways. My friend has this feeling of, you know, he works at a nonprofit organization and they do good work. They raise money for organizations that are trying to get started in Africa. And he says, hey, look, you know, why would I go to church when I can just go to my job and be more effective than what any of you do? And that really struck me and sort of made me sit back on my heels, and I didn't have much of a response. And I came to think about how Christ calls us to love our neighbors and our enemies, and how we can come together to stand against injustices that still occur in our societies. If we think that injustice is over and that the American Civil Rights Movement of the 60s was the end of injustice, well, I think we've missed the point. There's still so much that goes on today that we can stand against and have a voice against, a powerful voice, a nonviolent voice, a defiant voice, a unified voice. One of the things that strikes me most is I was just this morning, I watched the YouTube clip of the I Have a Dream speech, and just the way that he finishes that speech and just the way that there are millions of people gathered together in one unified voice saying, you know, we shall be free at last. What a powerful image, that unity. And they're not all Christians, mind you. They're not all black. They're not all white. It was such a unified group of disparate communities that came together over one idea that a nonviolent protest can change the world. And it did, and it still can. And it's that faith, that faith in Christ, and it's that love of our neighbors, that love of our enemies, which can be united together. Even though we can't control this world, even though we can't control the way creation sort of toys with us at times, that one unified stand, to show that to the world, that would be a powerful display of love. Amen.